Welcome to History and D&D. In the last episode, I explained how Dragonlance came to be at TSR, and how it ended up under Wizards of the Coast. This time, I'll talk about the elements of the Dragonlance story, and why it's awesome. This will be a deep dive into the story, plot, themes, and characters of the books. I'll discuss many of the important elements that make up the central conceit of the saga, so I can give you an understanding of what happens in the books, as well as the reason for why I love it. Chronicles is a trilogy of books that kick off the Dragonlance saga, of which the first book came out in 1984. That first book was Dragons of Autumn Twilight. Here are some of the concepts that are introduced within the story, and that are a prehistory of it, and affect the plot. In ancient times, the gods created the world, and then one of them, Takasis, attempted to conquer the world with her chromatic evil dragons. Another god, Paladine, helped defeat her. The armies that opposed her were assisted by metallic good dragons. Takasis was banished to the abyss, and the world moved on, until a few hundred years prior to the beginning of the Chronicles, a man called the King Priest demanded that the gods eliminate evil. In response, the gods threw a fire mountain at Kryn, the world of Dragonlance, and the impact changed the shape of the main continent of Ancelon. This was called the Cataclysm. The gods left the world, and a post-apocalyptic society eventually rose from the ashes, but post-apocalyptic in a similar fashion to the Dark Ages that followed the decline of Rome. Long after all this, a group of heroic adventurers from the village of Solas went their separate ways, agreeing to meet again at the end of the last home in 5 years. The first book begins as Tika Whalen is cleaning the end of the last home in Solas, and an old man enters. He says some strange things that are eventually are understood to be prophetic. Later, outside the village, Tanis Halfelvin reunites with Flint Fireforge the dwarf and Tasseloff Burfoot the Kender, just before the three of them get into a fight with a hobgoblin and his goblin warrior. The three later enter the tavern and meet other friends they had not seen since they parted 5 years prior. These friends are Sturm Brightblade, a knight of Salamnia, and the twins Caramon and Raistlin Magyre. Tanis receives a message from a strange bandaged monk who relays that Katara Uthmater, his lover and sister of Caramon and Raistlin, would not be attending. This is taken as a bad omen. During the discussions and revelry in the inn, two people were introduced with Sturm, Goldmoond and Riverwind, barbarians from the plains. These two are in possession of the blue crystal staff that is being sought by many, including the goblins, heretic priests, and the soon-to-be-introduced dragon armies. The adventurers will flee the tavern through the kitchen with Goldmoon and Riverwind, and that will begin the story. In this first book, these people, and a few others who will join later, will become the Companions, also known as the Heroes of the Lands. They'll visit several abandoned cities and uncover the armies of Takasis and her dragons, and the secrets they want to hide. The main secrets are her new attempt to conquer the world, and that there are other gods and dragons to oppose her. In the final third of the novel, three other characters will complete the roster of the Companions. Tika Whalen, the waitress turned warrior, Laura Lanthalassa, and her brother Gilthanas, who are elves from the nation of Quelenost, children of the ruler, and second cousins to Tanis, who is also called Tanthalas by his elven brethren. Lorana is his other love interest besides Katara. The Companions will defeat Lord Verminard and return the knowledge of the ancient gods to the world when Goldmoon becomes a cleric of Mishakal, retrieves the discs of Mishakal, and gives them to a former slave of the dragon armies named Elistam, who will become a priest of Paladine. In the second book, Dragons of Winter Night, the Companions will attempt to find passage for refugees of the war. They arrive in Tarsus by the sea, only to find that there is no sea due to the fact that hundreds of years ago, the Cataclysm drained the sea away. They will also learn that an invasion is imminent by the dragon armies. Due to the invasion, the party will be split with Sturm Brightblade, Lorana Kanan, Gilthanas Kanan, Flint Fireforge, Tasseloff Burfoot, and Elistan, traveling with newly met Salomnic knights Derek Crownguard, Aaron Talbot, and Brian Donner. The rest of the Companions, Tanis Halfelvin, Goldmoon, Riverwind, Tika Whalen, Caramon and Raistlin Magyre, will be rescued by an elf princess from Sylvanost named Alhanna Starbreeze. Before the party split, she was helped by Sturm, a and the two of them smoldered with admiration for one another, and she gave him a magic item called a star jewel. Sturm, Flint, Tass, Elistan, Lorana, and her brother will travel south, then northwest, discovering the titular Dragonlance, and learning of the existence of good metallic dragons, before a forget spell makes them not remember the dragons. They'll travel to the exiled elven nations, escape them, and then arrive in Salamnia for the Council of Whitestone, where the shape of the war will be set out. This group of companions will be vital to the defense of the city of Palanthas when they are stationed at a mountain pass at the Highclere's Tower. The other group of companions, Tanis, Caramon, Raistlin, Tika, Goldmoon, and Riverwind, will travel northeast to Sylvanos and free Elhanna's father, Lorak, from the great green dragon, Cyan Bloodpaint. The land around the elven city, ravaged by nightmares, will drag them and their friends they were split from into a dream where they will see their own deaths. Eventually, Raistlin will defeat an artifact called the Dragon Orb and take possession of it, and the dream will end. Leaving Elhanna and her father, they will travel to a village on the eastern coast named Flotsam, where a chance meeting will reunite Tanis with Katara Uthmeda. It will be revealed that she is one of the generals of the dragon armies, and the book will end with a massive battle led by her as she tries to take the High Claire's Tower, defended by Sturm, with his people and friends. The third book in the trilogy, Dragons of Spring Dawning, begins in Flotsam with Tanis trying to escape Katara with his friends. They are pursued by her across the sea until they enter the Maelstrom, a powerful, never-ending cyclonic storm in the middle of the sea, which is revealed to be centered over the sunken city of Ishtar, the once home of the King Priest who caused the cataclysm. They are betrayed by Raistlin before entering the Maelstrom, as he uses the Dragon Orb to teleport just himself out of there. The story moves to Lorana, Tasselhoff, and Flint in the city of Calaman, when Gil'thanas returns with good metallic dragons to help fight the war. Lorana, the elf princess and golden general of the armies of good, is captured by Katara's ally, Lord Soth, the Death Knight. Tanis and the others wash up on the shore near Calaman, reunite with Flint, Tass, and Gil'thanas, and set out to rescue Lorana. The story culminates at the main base of the dragon armies, among the mountains in a place called Meraka. After several close calls, as well as another betrayal by Raistlin, the dragon armies are defeated and left scattered. The War of the Lance is won. The story of the Chronicles can be thought of as a group of individuals coming together to oppose the forces of evil in a great war. And in so doing, they must overcome their own flaws and work together to save each other and the world. The second trilogy, Legends, came out in 1986, and is a more intimate tale, no less epic. Raistlin travels to the past to gain the power he needs to defeat Tacasus, so that he can become a god and supposedly end the suffering of the downtrodden. Caramon, with the help of Tasselhoff Burfoot, must try to stop him. The story continues to its culmination with time travel, alternate reality, a second War of the Lance, battles of the gods, and so much more. In this story, the characters learn and grow, becoming more than just heroes, especially Caramon and Tasselhoff, who both essentially become new people in the sense that they mature. Caramon becomes a whole person, no longer tied to his brother, and more sure of himself and his own abilities, while Tasselhoff learns to deal with sacrifice and loss. The three books of this trilogy are Time of the Twins, War of the Twins, and Test of the Twins. So let's talk about the characters and their story arcs. Tanis Half-Elven was the first Dragonlance character I encountered when I read a prequel book called Tanis the Shadow Years. In fact, I read many of the spin-off books before I read the main books I just outlined. By the time I read the main books, I was fairly familiar with the characters and excited to read the adventures that had been alluded to in other books. Tanis is a character that divides the fan base. Many love him, most do not seem to. Tracy Hickman, when asked for advice on writing him by Margaret Weiss, told her that he was an analog for Captain Kirk from Star Trek. I don't think this is quite right, but they do share one aspect that I think Tanis' detractors miss. He's decisive and a man of action, who can use the advice of others without letting his ego get in the way. I suppose many fans who dislike the half-elf don't see him that way, and in fact might perceive him the opposite way because his internal dialogue is riddled with conflict and doubt. But if you understand that someone who is supremely confident and unswerving inside their own head is probably a nutjob egomaniac, then his inner conflict is only a liability if it drives his actions. And in Tanis' case, that's rarely the case. Time and time again, within the stories, Tanis and his friends are confronted with obstacles. If he has the time, he consults the others, favoring those who have a particular expertise. But when it comes time to act, he does so quickly and decisively, for the most part. His own needs take a back seat to the course of action that benefits everyone. The one time he does let his own needs supersede that of others, it turns out so badly he never lets it happen again. When it comes to battle or diplomacy, he acts appropriately as he can to gain the best outcome that he can. He's pragmatic, wise, a man of action, and someone who is willing to make sacrifices. So I just don't see how fans of the series can discount him, especially since all the other characters look to him to lead for all of these reasons. As the series progresses, and more accolades from various people are thrust on Tanis, he becomes a legendary hero. This distresses him because he just wanted a simple life of anonymity, but his core being forces him to continually get involved when people need him, which is often. Raistlin Magyar is hands down the most popular character and generally the face of the series. He's both highly capable and conceited. As his insecurity decreases because his power grows, we get to see him be more human, but he rarely allows his vulnerability to show. He ultimately sacrifices his quest, the power he craves, his ambition, and his life to prevent the destruction of the world. This is partly because his path would lead to him ruling a dead, lonely world, which would just be a torture, pointless existence. But also, deep down, he begins to understand that the power he craves is not equal to the sacrifices required. He begins to see, in the end, that if he had taken a different path, his life would have been more fulfilling, and therefore, he makes the ultimate sacrifice in the hope that he can begin a path of redemption. Much later, years beyond the first two trilogies, he has moved quite far along his path to redemption, despite being dead. Caramon Magyar is a generally liked character because of his association with his brother Raistlin. His character is often used as a contrast with others, most notably his brother. He's strong and affable, while Raistlin is sickly and acerbic, which makes that character despised by many. Caramon follows while Tanis leads. He isn't constrained by honor and duty like Sturm. He's young and outgoing, unlike the old and crotchety dwarf Flint Fireforge. His naivety is not that of a child's, as is Tassoff Berflett's. By the time these first two trilogies come to an end, Caramon has become a whole person. While before, his existence was defined by his dysfunctional relationship with his brother, it is now defined by himself and the people he has gathered around him. His family, mostly his children, become essential players in the major events of later years. Tasselhoff Berflett begins the book as the comedic relief and as a proxy for the reader. A young person experiencing the book for the first time can look through Tass's eyes and feel like they're part of the companions. His lighthearted approach to life and the situational humor that occurs also provides necessary breaks in the seriousness of the story. But he's one of the least liked characters because his actions are nonsensical to adults. This is only in the sense that they may very well expect him to be more serious and adult when neither his character nor the culture he comes from has prepared him to be. His growth becomes more striking than the other characters because at times he can be very non-Kender. These breaks from his culture and the way a Kender acts are significant because it is so rare for Kender to become serious and mature. Sturm Brightblade is probably almost as popular as Raistlin is amongst diehard fans. He's the heroic knight who sacrifices himself in battle so that the war can be eventually won. What's not to love? But he's also one of the characters who shows the least amount of growth. He remains relatively rigid in his beliefs, and events do not come close to making a new person of him. He somewhat overcomes his insecurities, but only to trade those for more rigidly grasping his honor. He uses his internal honor to stand his ground against overwhelming odds and sacrifices himself to stem the tide. This gives a reprieve for the forces of good, so of course he's a fan favorite. His son with Katara, named Steel Brightblade, is cut from the same cloth as him, and essentially has a similar story arc in the future beyond the first two trilogies. Flint Fireforge is the grandfather of the group, and serves to remind the reader how serious the consequences can be for both the companions and the world at large. He's the counterpoint to Tasselhoff, as a character within the plot and as a person. It's no wonder that they are so often linked within the story as a sort of odd couple. Goldmoon is the heart of the group and provides both wisdom and love. She keeps them grounded in friendship at important junctures, when maybe the hardships they face would push them apart and into an early demise. That aspect of her character arc is every bit as important as the vital role she plays as a messenger of the gods, but it often gets overlooked as people focus on her role as the first cleric after the Cataclysm. Riverwind is a man who has always been outside society and is used to being solitary. He is racist towards others and also suffers racism from others. He is a man who knows some truth and is ridiculed for it until he finds friends who can help him bring his truth to the world. His loyalty to his friends helps him overcome many flaws, while his stubbornness slows this process at times. But as the first trilogy comes to a close, he is well on his way to being the venerated leader he becomes in later stories. Lorana Kanan had an idyllic and happy childhood as a princess of the elven court of Quel'Anesti. She is a young woman who must quickly grow up in the middle of a war. She is scarred by the war, but her eternal strength allows her to turn those scars into a metatextual armor she uses to move through the new world and fight the battles she needs to fight. Gil'thanas Kanan is brooding and in search of himself. He first enters the story as a previous companion of Tanis, who he had a falling out with because of his own racist outlook. He could not accept the affection Tanis shared with Gil'thanas' sister Lorana, and Tanis left their home of Quel'Anesti after that. This is juxtaposed by Gil'thanas beginning to respect Tanis again after seeing that man's accomplishments and leadership on display, as well as Gil'thanas himself having fallen in love with a dragon. Tika Whale in Magyre is likely the most relatable character for readers. She's depicted in one of three states. 1. The laborer who becomes a small business owner. She begins as a waitress at the inn of the last home and ends up owning it. 2. A pragmatic warrior and a hero of the lands. What she lacks in training, she makes up for in ingenuity. She can fight with a sword, but pots and pans are almost as deadly in her hands. 3. She's a parent, not just of her biological children, but of nearly anyone she meets, including her husband at times. Her pragmatism really comes out when she's directing people with common sense advice. Tika was the only child of a single parent. When her father disappeared, Otik, the owner of the last home, took her in. She then traveled as one of the companions, married Caramon, had children, and took over the inn. She's the Everman character, who just happens to be a woman. The authors use these characters and the themes expertly to drive the plot. What these characters share are certain goals, morals, and an estrangement or lack of family. They are each searching for a family through the bonds they create, and each character could be perceived as similar to a member of the reader's own family. Here are some of the most prevalent themes in the saga. Romantic love has many forms. Tanis is in a love triangle with Lorana and Katara. Caramon and Tika's love begins with lust and turns into marriage and an almost nuclear family. Goldmoon and Riverwind have a romance built on destiny. Sturm has a mutual, unrequited, and forbidden love with Ohana Starbreeze. As well, Sturm and Katara had a night of passion when they were young that produced a child, and end up having both a distaste for the other's methods and a respect for their prowess. Gil'thanas has a very complicated and forbidden love with a silver dragon, so an interspecies love. Familiar love becomes more obvious in the series after the first 6 books, but most of the characters are in some state of abandonment or estrangement from their original family, and replace that family with loyalty to each other. There are many points in which racism drives the plot or characters. Riverwind is initially cool to Tanis because he distrusts elves. Elves often distrust humans. Dwarves distrust elves. Some races are treated as a social subclass, such as gnomes, kender, and especially gully dwarves. The dragon armies comprise mostly of humans, draconians, goblins, ogres, and their evil goddess Takasis hate elves. There is internecine dislike, exploitation, and betrayal between the 4 dwarf cultures of Mountain Dwarf, Hill Dwarf, Durgar, and Gully Dwarf. The theme of ambition mostly centers around the villains. So clearly, the sub-theme of that is the cost of ambition. The phrase which explains the loss by the dragon armies and Takasis, evil turns upon itself, encapsulates this theme. Especially because Takasis prizes ambition and punishes failure. Whereas the heroes learn from failure, unite, and ultimately succeed. Even Rhys Lynn, with his attempt to become a god, cannot pay the cost of his ambition and eventually learns that a lust for power is a shallow path to victory. several characters are defined by the bullying they encountered while young. Raistlin is the most obvious case, as it is stated time and again how much Caramon had to shield his twin from the constant bullying from other children. But Caramon suffers from psychological bullying by Raistlin, who wrongly justifies it as a reaction to Caramon's overbearing protection. Sturm is also bullied because people generally blame the knighthood he belongs to with injustices in the past due to their inability to shield regular folk from the deprivations following the Cataclysm. Tanis is subtly bullied by both elves and humans for his mixed-race status. Tassiloff is bullied by everyone because his naivete annoys others, especially Flint. The overarching theme of wartime is baked right into the story. Even the peacetime becomes just a reprieve between wars. Most characters within the series become their true selves because of their reaction to the war. The idea of the monster within is mirrored by the actual living monster without. Each character deals with a dark heart, and the heroes overcome their own impulses to save the world and to contrast themselves from their monstrous enemies. Sometimes within the series, but most often in later books, monstrous characters are humanized as the spectrum of morality becomes less black and white and more shades of gray. Many characters are defined by their faults, and much of the story is driven by overcoming faults. The heroes learn to transcend their flaws, while the villains most often embrace or ignore theirs to their detriment. The themes of lost things, lost people, and discovery are all intertwined and often used as metaphor and similes for each other. The characters have to find themselves, each other, the secrets of the world, the answers to their questions, many lost places, concepts, and artifacts. As well, they have to recover history so they can use the triumph of the past to overcome the threat of the present. With this saga having been rooted in play sessions and written by employees who worked for the company that made Dungeons & Dragons, adventure is right in your face. The covers, painted by the great Larry Elmore, scream adventure. The theme of personal growth becomes more obvious in the Legends trilogy, as you see how years after the first story, the characters have changed and they continue to grow, becoming their best selves by the end. Good versus evil, man versus man, and man's nature are intertwined thematic elements that support and elevate the narrative. The initial conflict driving the series is very black and white, but it slowly starts to shift into gray, so that later in the series, it becomes almost a philosophical discussion on the natures of evil and people. Man versus nature often comes and goes within the series as the characters travel through hostile environments to get from one place to another. Nature often acts as an obstacle, but often it's other characters who become the true obstacle and figuratively represent forces of nature themselves. The main theme that all these other ideas intersect through and branch off of is the idea that love, loyalty, and selflessness can overcome hate, perfidy, and selfishness. There are some elements that continually drive the narrative, the characters, and they are referenced often. For instance, the Cataclysm was obviously a traumatic experience for those who lived it, but that trauma, as well as the physical event, ripples through history and the people that lived afterwards. The Fire Mountain struck the world, reshaping the map as new seas emerged and land disappeared, but even more traumatic must have been that the gods seemed to turn their back on everyone, including the innocent. Imagine living in a world where the gods were accessible and you could have a relationship with them, and suddenly they were gone after destroying everything. The companions are the most important mortals that have walked the world. While there have been many people who have performed great deeds before them, the legacy of the Heroes of the Lance affects every race and nation. They are the world's heroes. The nations are distinct from one another, and that creates interesting conflict beyond the war in question. Salamnia is a feudal land of gallant, honorable knights, as well as a few opportunistic cats, masking as knights. Quellenost and Sylvanost are two elven nations that used to be one, but grew apart culturally. Palanthus is an almost city-state within Salamnia. Tarsus is a city-state, long since declined, as its economic activity never rebounded from the environmental disaster of the Cataclysm. The dwarven kingdom of Thorbarden is a fortress within a mountain that was once much greater. Istar is a nation whose destruction came so long ago that it's barely remembered for anything except the king priest. The gods, especially Tacitus and Paladine, are active within the world once the war begins, but all the other gods can be experienced. In some respects, the stories of this world resemble Greek myth. The novels were written to support game books because some brain trust once told executives at TSR that D&D had lots of dungeons, but not so many dragons. So the abundance of dragons is a result of that, but their variety, use within the narrative, and distinct personalities are a result of the writing. The Wars of the Lance are a sprawling epic and love letter to our own mythology and several other works of fantasy. But, most important, they are a unique and new story that brought together everything that the authors knew, and from that, an amazing fantasy world was born. These wars are the crucible that shows us what heroes are. Each of these elements set up a backdrop within the story of conflict and despair. And it is this that the characters themselves contrast as they bring back hope and peace to the world. To sum up everything here, the Dragonlance saga, which begins in the book Dragons of Autumn Twilight, is centered around the first six core books, which are two trilogies called Chronicles and Legends. In those books, the companions, which are also called the Heroes of the Lance, come together to help win an epic dragon war, and the results of that victory reverberate throughout the world. These people must overcome many obstacles, including their own flaws, so that the world can be saved and hope can be returned to the masses. It's an epic story of good versus evil, love and hate, all wrapped up in adventure and heroics. But at the center of the story are the people, and each of them is a flawed individual looking for a way to belong to something bigger than themselves. I realize now that despite this long-winded love letter to Dragonlance, I barely scratched the surface. Which is good news to fans and newcomers alike. There is a great supply of novels and supplementary material to sink your teeth into. The story continues in nearly 200 other novels, as well as comic books, video games, and as part of the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game. And I mentioned before that Dragonlance ended at Wizards of the Coast in 2008, when they stopped licensing the gaming side of it, and again in 2010 when the last new novel was published. But if you're looking for ways to get into Dragonlance or support it, there are still a few avenues. Contacting Wizards and asking them for information on Dragonlance will alert them to its continued popularity, as will buying the books that are still in print and purchasing game materials. The physical books are available on Margaret Weiss's website as well as Amazon. There are ebook and audiobook versions available through various sources. The game materials are available on dmsguild.com. If you're looking to connect with the larger fan base of the series, there are Facebook groups, as well as the Dragonlance Nexus, a website, and a podcast associated with it called the Dragonlance Canticle. In the next episode, I will discuss various aspects of role-playing and touch on some misconceptions. This has been History and D&D. Hadad, and I hope your day is free of thunderbolts.